Welcome to the Humble Hoof Podcast. My name is Alicia Harlov. This is a podcast for both horse owners and hoof care professionals, offering discussions into various philosophies on the health of the hoof and soundness of your horse. Please check us out on Facebook or at thehumblehoof.com. A special thank you to our wonderful sponsor, Cavallo. For our Humble Hoof listeners, they are offering 15% off their Cavallo Trek hoof boots using the coupon code HRN at checkout. The Trek is the world's most popular and versatile hoof boot and Cavallo's toughest trail boot, while also doubling as an option for therapy or rehab. The front closure system makes it easily adaptable to various hoof shapes, and the TPU gaiter allows for maximum strength while minimizing weight for the comfort and ease of movement for your horse. These are recommended by vets and trainers and also loved as transport boots by barrel racers, show jumpers, dressage riders, and everyone in between. Again, for 15% off a pair of Treks, use the code HRN at checkout at cavallo-inc.com. It's officially fall in the Northern Hemisphere, and that means that we're seeing an uptick of a lot of different issues that come along with owning horses. One of the most common things we see is horses that are struggling with laminitis this time of year. I reached out to Dr. Kellen, Dr. Rowe, and Dr. Mesa with Mad Barn to talk about pasture-associated laminitis as well as what might cause laminitis in the fall. I wanted to give a huge shout out to Mad Barn for sponsoring our 2025 Humble Hoof Podiatry Clinic. It is sold out, but there are still options for watching video recordings and live stream for the lectures and demos for this event. Also, don't forget to use code THEHUMBLEHOOF for 5% off at your checkout at madbarn.com. Do you want to start and maybe talk a little bit about your background and how you kind of became involved in equine nutrition or even at Mad Barn and kind of a little your journey in the equine world?
Yeah, for sure. So in my doctoral training, I was at animal physiology at the University of Florida, and I studied endocrine dysregulations, mainly in reproductive biology rather than insulin, which we'll discuss today. But I've been with Mad Barn for the last 3 years. I've always been a horse enthusiast, and I made my way back to the equine world. And the many cases I worked through alongside Dr. Kellen, Dr. Rowe, and the rest of the team have taught me a lot about metabolic health in horses. So I'm really happy to be part of the discussion today.
Yeah, that's amazing. And obviously, it's a very, you know, something that I'm really interested in because I have a hoof rehab facility. And I feel like most of the horses that I see, no matter what sort of ailment they're dealing with hoof-wise, a lot of them end up coming back to some degree of a metabolic issue or laminitic issue, because that's the ones that a lot of times a traditional kind of barn setup in my area is not quite catered to dealing with. So they struggle at these properties where they're on grass all the time, or they're, you know, getting a traditional grain meal twice a day. And then, you know, they end up moving to a situation that is more catered to that kind of issue. So I love that, you know, Mad Barn has done so much in really looking into those kind of things, too. And yeah, I would love to talk about laminitis today. I know this time of year we're seeing a lot of issues, and I'm not sure if you all have heard from various customers or horse owners that are dealing with problems right now.
Yeah, I definitely think it's starting to ramp up a bit now that we're just about to cross the threshold into fall. Yeah, I would say I've gotten a couple more correspondence about it. Same for you guys, I would think, too.
Yeah, some horses will start as early as July, and you know, every year they back it up a little bit. Those are the ones that are the early Cushing's cases, usually. It just gets a little bit worse and a little bit earlier every year.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, obviously, if people are listening to this podcast, I assume they have some idea what laminitis is. But if we want to kind of start at the very basics, for those who might be new to the topic, does anybody want to kind of briefly explain what laminitis is and how it affects horses?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, always good to start at the beginning for just to make sure everyone's on the same page. So when we talk about laminitis, we're talking about a condition that describes essentially inflammation. That's where the itis comes from. Inflammation of the lamina in the hook. And the lamina are like microscopic Velcro is kind of how I like to describe them. And that Velcro connects the hoof wall to the coffin bone, which is that small bone that's actually with held within the hoof capsule. And the lamina are the kind of main support structure that actually holds the foot together and really supports the entire weight of the horse, which is sort of, you know, a remarkable thing to think about for a, you know, 1100 pound animal, that this microscopic Velcro is really what's keeping these horses on all four legs. So when we think about inflammation occurring in this structure in the hoof, that inflammatory process and any, you know, damage that occurs to this tissue really results in instability, which is one, extremely painful for the horse, but two, it also disrupts the structural integrity of the hoof. And in really severe cases, that coffin bone can actually rotate or sink within the hoof capsule. And, you know, most listeners are going to be kind of maybe more familiar with the colloquial term founder, which is really describing those more severe cases where you get coffin bone movement. When thinking about laminitis in horses, we generally talk about it presenting in kind of two ways, either acutely or chronically. Acute laminitis describes those horses with a really sudden onset of lameness. They have hoof heat. They have bounding digital pulses. I think that's sort of the classic picture that most owners would kind of have in their mind when they picture laminitis. Versus horses with chronic laminitis usually have this more low grade or kind of insidious onset. These horses might not look obviously lame or have that kind of classic laminitic look, but hallmarks of chronic laminitis include divergent hoof rings, stretching of the white line on the sole of foot, and kind of abnormal hoof shape or hoof growth. And so ultimately, laminitis is a really serious issue. I think that might be a bit of an understatement, but it's a really serious issue. It can, you know, negatively affect the horse's quality of life. It can affect that horse's, you know, athletic potential or ability to, you know, perform some type of job. And it can definitely be life-threatening in really severe cases.
Yeah. And something that I learned from the ECIR group years ago was, you know, laminitis is a symptom. It's not a, you know, disease process in itself necessarily. So I was wondering if any of you want to talk about some of the most common causes or triggers of laminitis.
I would say that the itis part of laminitis doesn't really apply to the metabolic cases. And over 90% of the laminitis that we see is caused by high insulin, either with Cushing's disease or metabolic syndrome. And those horses have a weakening and elongation of their lamina rather than inflammation per se. The inflammation goes with all the other causes, like retained placenta, grain overload, overheating, you know, heat stress, things like that, Potomac horse fever, strangled. All of those things are inflammatory types of laminitis that cause a white blood cell infiltrate into the tissue and typical inflammatory reactions, whereas the metabolic ones don't do that. And that's why drugs like phenylbutazone don't work all that well, because they're primarily addressing laminitis, you know, the itis form, the inflammatory form, rather than the changes that are going on with high insulin.
That makes sense. And so, you know, I've always thought of the, like you mentioned, those two forms and then having a third major cause of laminitis as the supporting limb laminitis. Would that be more, well, that's more ischemia. I guess I should let you guys talk about that.
That's actually a physical tearing that the tissue breaks down. It's a physical failure of the tissue to be able to hold that much weight. And that results in an inflammatory reaction, but the inflammation doesn't cause it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So in terms of, and I know this isn't one of the questions that I asked, but it's something that I mean, I'm sure that you've talked about many times on the ECIR group and I should review, but when it comes to the metabolic form and you're talking about the high insulin leading to those changes in the lamina and either from PPID or EMS, when a PPID horse is laminitic, is that always due to high insulin or how is the ACTH playing a role in that process?
Yeah, it's always due to high insulin, but ACTH increases cortisol. Cortisol induces insulin resistance. But all the other hormones, like the partial products of ACTH, like CRP, and there's another one, beta something or other, and even the melanocyte-stimulating hormone, they all have the ability to some extent, at least in other species, cause insulin resistance. But we do all, you always see higher insulin.
Okay, yeah. And in terms of, you know, something that I think a lot of people are seeing in the summer, or maybe it's starting to slowly back off due to the fact that we're here, at least in a drought in our area of the world. What about the pasture-associated laminitis specifically? So can you talk a little bit about what that is due to and what makes pasture a risk for these horses?
It's the same thing. It's insulin related. Mm-hmm. You can't take, I've never seen a normal non-insulin resistant horse get pasture laminitis. There's just simply not enough sugar and starch in grass to cause this in a normal horse. So it only happens to horses that are insulin resistant and can't tolerate those high levels of carbohydrates. We think of it typically as in the spring when the grass is growing rapidly, and that's true. There's very high sugar then. But stressed pastures, like pastures that are under drought stress, also have high sugars. Overgrazed horses or pastures also have high sugars. When grass is regrowing after a drought, there's a sugar spike. And that also happens in the fall. So there are a lot of different scenarios where the pasture can be a problem for these horses. Even the time of day. I mean, in the morning, the sugars are normally lowest and they peak around 3 or 4 o'clock. And when the nights are warm, those sugars get used up overnight. But when the nights are cold, they don't go down. So that's yet another scenario.
And in terms of horses that are struggling with having a laminitic reaction when they're grazing, are there, I know you're talking about all the different ways or times that the sugars in the grass can be increased. Are there times when these horses might be, seem like they're fine on grass and then they suddenly tank or have a bad reaction? Would you immediately assume that those horses are metabolic?
If they're having a reaction to grass,
I think a lot of times I see horse owners that, you know, their horse will be grazing, you know, a few months and they're like, oh, my horse is just fine. They're on grass. There's no problem. And then all of a sudden one of those issues pops up, like there's new growth or there's a change in season or change in temperatures. And all of a sudden their horse becomes sore.
Yeah, you have to do a little detective work here. I mean, there are things too, like Lyme disease, for example. That can present as laminitis. You have to really narrow. You have to just get into that case and go through all the possible factors and narrow everything down.
Yeah, absolutely. So, in terms of if we know for sure that a horse has a metabolic problem, what are some of the key dietary management strategies for those horses, especially if they have a history of laminitis? What are some steps that you would take?
So in general, we want their diet to be based in forage and ideally in hay because everything we talk about, different sugar levels in the pasture. But the whole diet should be low in hydrolyzable carbohydrates, which are the sum of ESC sugar, ethanol-soluble carbohydrates, plus starch. And these are the values we look at a hay analysis. So these are the sugars and the carbohydrates that are important because they drive insulin spikes. So the best way to know if the diet is below 10% is to know those values from the hay and if they're eating anything on the side. then the sum should be below 10%. So the best way to know that is to be able to test a hay. So if you have a place to store and analyze the hay, that would be a great investment. Or some hay suppliers already have a hay analysis. So that will clarify part of the big part of the diet, which is the forage. If you don't have a hay analysis, we do recommend to do soak the hay for like half an hour to an hour to help reduce some of those sugars, and then to identify if there are other components of the diet are also low on these sugars and starch. So like Dr. Kellen said, pasture management is another big piece because the sugars in the grass fluctuate a lot throughout the day. So safer options to allow graze would be time turnout with a grazing muzzle and dry lot with hay access. So a muzzle may seem restrictive, but I would argue that it could be the opposite. A properly fitted muzzle will still allow horses to graze, drink, and most importantly, stay with their herd. And that social interaction is a very critical part of welfare. Without a muzzle, you're risking the health. And the alternative would be stall confinement or isolation, which can also cause stress.
Right. Yeah. And I know that, you know, some owners assume that, you know, just because they're soaking the hay, that nothing else in the diet matters necessarily. So I like that you pointed out that anything fed on the side also has to be looked at, because I see that a lot with owners when I go to see their horses off property. They might be feeding them, you know, 6 pounds of a grain because that's what the minimum daily requirement is alongside their soaked hay. So, yeah, that's something that I definitely think owners should watch out for as well.
Yeah, and if they have a different hay analysis to choose from, they can send it to a equine nutritionist and we can help them choose. And yeah, just controlling those will make a big difference on their metabolic health.
Yeah. And so in terms of, you know, most of the insulin resistant horses that I see, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are very hefty, pretty, you know, they have the classic fat pads and they're pretty overweight. I know that a lot of owners are looking for ways to make sure that their weight is kept in check. So I know that you mentioned soaking the hay and using a muzzle, but are there any other practical tips that we can use for monitoring and maintaining our horse's weight?
Yeah, for sure. And the differentiation that you made, it's a really good one because not every metabolic horse is overweight and not every overweight horse is metabolic. However, if we know for any of those scenarios, exercise would be an excellent first piece of management, weight management. Regular movement improves insulin sensitivity. It uses up calories and it helps muscle building, which makes glucose regulation more efficient. So light work, walking, trotting, hill work, anything can make a difference. And if a horse is sound, that would be the first ideal measurement to take. The second one would be monitoring the weight, being able to track the progress of the horse. So taking photos from the front, side, and behind, keeping an eye on the neck, which is one of the sites where fats deposit accumulate. Keeping the same angle and distance when taking these photos will help them to be more comparable. And if you're able to use a body condition score just to stay more objective, putting hands on the horse is really important because you can feel ribs or fat pads going along the limbs, making sure there's no pain, no heat. And then another very important strategy for weight management would be to use hay nets. A lot of horses are really fast eating, so just hay nets will regulate the intake a little bit more. Sometimes we need to ration the hay for these horses. So having them on nets will allow them to spend more time eating, which promotes a better digestion too.
Yeah, and I know that a lot of owners, when they have a horse that's sore or laminitic, they're kind of looking for that magic bullet. And obviously there's no real magic bullet when it comes to anything in horses. But are there specific nutrients that you see that play a large role in supporting metabolic health for these horses?
Yeah, for sure. Utilizing a vitamin mineral balance would be another important step. So when we do hay analysis, we do look at the sugars and the starch, but we also want to be able to balance the minerals so they promote a healthy metabolic response. So using products that don't add additional sugar, starch, calories, it is an excellent way to be able to supply those nutrients that forage often lacks, especially hay, and not add more fuel to the problem.
Yeah, and that's something that we do at my farm too, is we obviously test all our hay. I just tested this year's 2025 hay last week. We just got our first load. And then we work to do the math to sort of balance the minerals for that. And I know we've talked about that before with Mad Barn on the podcast, but I didn't know if anybody wanted to give kind of a brief summary about why mineral balancing can be important for these horses.
One thing I would say is that at the upcoming 25th anniversary No Laminitis Conference, Frisk is going to give a talk on exactly that and the results that we had from using Omega Trace Plus on a farm full of assorted metabolic horses. Some of it, they're all important, really. I mean, it's hard to pick out one thing and say this is the most important. But we look at magnesium has been identified as a key element in many other species. And I think it is in horses too. And we just try to get the calcium magnesium balance right in line with the calcium phosphorus balance at 2-1. Then you get to the trace minerals. And we already did the podcast on the evil of iron. And iron is counteracted by copper and zinc. And manganese, but it's, manganese kind of has a double-sworded thing here. Because when manganese is high, it displaces iron from ferritin. So it actually makes iron overload worse, even if it doesn't allow for increased amounts of iron to be absorbed. It's a little bit complicated on that one. Selenium is an antioxidant, just like copper and zinc are. And those are important because it's been demonstrated that there is an increased pro-oxidant load in metabolic horses. Vitamin E is always deficient if you're not supplementing it when the horse is on a hay diet. Vitamin A, if the hay is too old. And those are probably the biggest ones.
Yeah, and so when owners are supplementing all these, is there a concern for toxicity in any of them or over-supplementation?
With vitamin A, is probably the closest where it could come to overdoing it, I think. Vitamin E is very non-toxic. Copper and zinc have extremely large tolerances in horses, and so does manganese. It's usually not an issue at all. You don't even come close to something that's toxic, unless you have a really extreme A. Like I just got one the other day where the zinc came in at over 300 parts per million. I just don't believe it.
Oh, wow. I don't think I've ever seen that.
It's usually more like 30.
Yeah.
And if you tried to balance to that, you might be pushing your luck a little bit. And so, yeah. Some of the iron hay are too high to really balance correctly. But a lot of times with them, if you just shake them or dunk them and retest them, it comes down enough to be in a workable range.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so obviously we're focusing on forage analysis as kind of the basis for really honing in the diets. Are there specific numbers that owners should look for in a hay test for a metabolic horse specifically?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So whenever, we are looking at hay analyses, and I certainly encourage owners who are, learning how to manage their metabolic horse, get savvy and kind of reading analyses, because it's going to become such a critical part of their horse's management. But kind of the big things that we'll initially look at for forage analyses are, Dr. Mesa already kind of alluded to this in her discussion a bit earlier, but are the ethanol soluble carbohydrates and the starch levels, which we sum together to give us the total hydrolyzable carbohydrate level of the hay. So It is really important to note, though, for you guys that might be sending out hay analyses, not all labs test carbohydrates with their basic or kind of entry-level package. It might be an add-on that you have to request. So it's just really important to know what service, you know, for the service that you're using, what package or add-ons you're going to need to make sure you get all of the information that you actually need. So I always like to remind everybody that. But when you look at the forage analysis and you do have carbohydrates on your analysis, you're going to be looking at the ESC or ethanol soluble carbohydrates and the starch value, which is going to be provided as a percentage in the dry matter column. And then you'll sum these two together to get a total hydrolyzable carbohydrate percentage. And for some listeners, you might be more familiar with non-structural carbohydrate or NSC value as sort of the term that we'll use. And that's sort of an older term. HC or hydrolyzable carbohydrate is a little bit more of a specific or newer term that's kind of better describes these two carbohydrate values or the sum of them anyway. So that's why we're using it in this in this podcast today. But ideally, you want your HC to be less than 10%. So that's kind of really the big thing that we'll be looking at for as a first step to kind of determine, is this hay going to be appropriate for this metabolic horse, or are the carbohydrates low enough to be appropriate? But there are a lot of other values on a forage analysis. And for any listener who's ever gotten one back, they're probably going to be, it can be really overwhelming to first look at the report and see all these numbers and not really understand what they all mean. So for any listeners that do feel overwhelmed or just don't have the experience in interpreting a forage analysis, you can always send them to a qualified nutritionist or send them to us at Mad Barn, and we can help you review and just help pick through the details and determine which forage is going to be most appropriate for your situation.
Well, I noticed that you had mentioned, you know, just the ESC and starch, and obviously NSC would include the water-soluble carb. So is there, you know, what's the reason for kind of not including the fructans in that equation?
The reason is that they can't be digested to a simple sugar and absorbed, so they don't affect insulin. Back probably 20 years ago or so, they were thought to be the cause of at least fall laminitis, and fructans really go up. But it has since been very clearly shown by a number of studies that insulin is the culprit here. And fructan's not digestible in the small intestine. So it doesn't cause a glucose rise. It doesn't get an insulin response. And that's why we ignore it. The other thing is, if you include it, like for many, many years, a lot of people were arguing, well, you should include it just because it raises calories or just because it might whatever. But what happens is, if you base your selection of hay on WSC plus starch, you're going to rule out a lot of perfectly safe hay. And a lot of times you're going to end up with really poor quality hay, even low protein hay that requires protein supplementation that increases or this risk. Because some protein can cause an insulin response. So it's just not appropriate to consider it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, you know, I test all my hay, like I said, and I have some fairly sensitive horses on the property. And I mean, knock on wood, they've done really well with looking at the ESC and starch. Just, you know, with keeping, I mean, on average, the insulin results we get here are in the single digits. Granted, they do live on a track, so that's a huge portion of, you know, they're exercising a lot. But I have had horses that have been sore here, even living on the track when they weren't eating it, when they were eating something that wasn't appropriate. So it's been interesting to see the hay test and how that kind of correlates with their comfort. So in terms of obviously the hay testing, and I know that Dr. Rowe mentioned that some places might not have the sugar and starch as their basic package and things like that. What's the best way to go about hay testing, and what are some places that people can send that to?
Yeah, so I would say whenever, if ever possible, every new batch of hay that you get in should ideally be tested. I know it's not always feasible for owners just because their hay, you know, maybe they're in a boarding situation and their hay supply changes a lot or they don't really have control over it. But if you do have control over it and really want to, you know, get into the nitty gritty of managing your metabolic horse, ideally every new batch would be tested. And we always like to remind people that just because, you know, that hay may come from the same farmer or it's harvested from the same field does not guarantee that a previous analysis is going to be representative. And that's especially true when it comes to starch and sugar content, just because starches and sugars are highly dependent on harvest conditions or maturity of the plant, you know, even time of day when that grass is cut to hay. So just as much as possible, whenever possible, test every batch. And if you can't, then, you know, going with the kind of erring on the side of the caution with the strategy of soaking the hay can be a really great way to just make sure that starches and sugars are, you're kind of minimizing starch and sugar if you don't have the option to know for certain. When testing, you know, you don't have to have fancy tools. You know, Forage Probe is sort of the gold standard for testing. It just allows you to get a really excellent sample. But if you don't have a Forage Probe available, I would suspect most listeners don't, you can do kind of what we call a hand grab method. And that can still, you know, give you a really great representative sample for your lot of hay. And really kind of the key is you just want to sample from multiple bales in your lot to achieve a representative sample. And then you'll package and sample per the lab's instructions. Every lab should provide you with how they like that to be packaged. And then you'll drop it off in person or mail it in and then wait for your results, which generally, depending on the lab or depending on how busy they are, shouldn't take too long. If you do test through somebody like us at Mad Barn, we do offer forage testing, which you can find under the Learn tab on our website. Our base package for forage testing includes NIR starch and sugar. But for those owners who have horses with metabolic concerns, we do recommend the add-on for wet chemistry starch and sugar. It's just the gold standard for a more accurate calculation or determination of starch and sugar in that forage. And you'll see this option at checkout, so you won't miss it. And then the nice thing, too, is if you go through Mad Barn, you know, our nutritionists will provide you with a comprehensive interpretation of the analysis. And also, you know, you'll get connected with a nutritionist, too. So it really, you get a lot of bang for your buck if you go through Mad Barn. But there are a lot of independent labs out there that, you know, offer very, you know, excellent service with good results. So, you know, certainly see what's, you know, cost effective or easy for your area.
That's great. And is that a new service from Mad Barn or have you guys always had it?
We've always had it. Or at least I think so, right, Dr. Mesa? At least for as long as you've been here, right?
We've had it for over a year, but before that, we did not offer it. So it is relatively new.
Okay.
A year or so, yeah. Or
yeah, 2 years. I didn't realize that. That's so great, especially because you have it with the, you know, option to talk to somebody about it. Because a lot of times I'll have clients who, you know, I'll say, you really should test your hay. And they pull a hay test and they send this to, you know, send it to me. And they're like, what the heck am I looking at? They have no idea what it means. So, and luckily, you know, I have taken Dr. Kellen's courses on mineral balancing and things like that so I can help them. But some people don't have anybody who would be able to read it for them. So having Mad Barn as a...
Absolutely. Resource. And even if you don't test your hay through Mad Barn, we will still look at any analysis you send us. So awesome. Don't let that dissuade you from reaching out if you need help.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Well, I mean, I hear it all the time from different owners. There are so many different things that they say when I try to tell them what they should do for their metabolic or their laminitic horse. You know, they always have these ideas that they've heard of why something's not a problem. So I would say that this time of year, one of the most common things that I hear is that, you know, their grass isn't green anymore because we're in a drought. So their horse, it can't be the grass, or, you know, their horse is fine to be out on their pasture because it's brown. So kind of looking at some of the myths with feeding metabolic horses, you know, is brown grass safe? Or, you know, is dormant grass safe? And what does that kind of look like?
It's not always safe, especially if stressed. Dormant grass stays alive by having high sugars. If it didn't have high sugar, it would be dead. Mm. And when grasses are stressed by either drought or cold or something like that, they ramp up the sugar. They release sugar from their reserves, and their sugar gets pretty high. There are horses that founder in winter pastures every year. But the other thing to consider at this time of year is undiagnosed PPID Cushing's horses, because fall laminitis can be the very first sign of it, especially if the horse has EMS, because there's a naturally occurring rise in ACTH and those other hormones at this time of year. It peaks the third week in September. But the laminitis occurs anytime from mid to late July through November. Their hormones go very high if they're early cases, and it tips their EMS significantly, and they can become laminitic. And especially if you have a horse that's showing unexplained laminitis for the first time in its life in teens, I mean, that's very highly suspicious. And we see this every year.
Yeah, and I will say, I mean, I get emails or messages daily from people who listen to the podcast. And the most common one I get this time of year is that their horse is just tanking and they think that they're going to have to consider euthanasia. And my first question back is, you know, how old is the horse and have you tested for PPID? because this time of year is when I see a lot of my clients that, like you said, are either, you know, an early undiagnosed case or a horse that's has been diagnosed, but maybe the ACTH isn't as controlled as it should be. And all of a sudden they start going downhill right around now. And the owners just assume it's their time. And that's not necessarily the case. You know, there's so much we can do to kind of manage that and look at adjusting medication or looking at better ways to kind of control their PPID. But yeah, I just want to put that in there because I can't even tell you this week how many messages I got about that.
Yeah, it's the time of year.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I see often, at least I feel like the owners that I work with trust me a little bit more than this, but I have some people that will mention to me that they think that grazing muzzles are cruel or inhumane. So I would love to hear what you all think about grazing muzzles and how restrictive are they, or how do they affect the horse's mental and emotional state or anything like that?
Picture the alternative is the response I usually give them. Just like Dr. Mesa said, it really is an improvement over stall confinement or confinement to a dry lot alone. It lets them graze to a limited amount. It lets them interact with their herd mates. It lets them drink and move around. And it's actually an improvement on the quality of life. Say, or the alternative is no muzzle at all and just let them founder. And that's just not an option in my book.
Right.
Yeah. I would say, too, that, you know, most horses adjust to a muzzle really well. I mean, maybe the first day or two they wear it, they are indignant about it or they hate it. But I would say most you know, adjust and transition very, very well, very quickly. And as long as that muzzle is fitted properly to the horse's head, it's comfortable. It's no different than wearing a halter or something like that. So, you know, I think in situations where owners maybe have had a bad experience with a muzzle or felt like their horse had a bad experience, potentially the muzzle just did not fit properly and maybe it was too tight. So they got muzzle rubs, or, you know, it was too loose and the horse could get it off really easily. There are some Houdini horses that are quite good at that. But by and large, they adapt very well to the muzzle. So I would say it's just a really essential tool in our toolbox for these guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And I even have some, you know, I have horses of varying needs on my two track systems. And I have had times where I've had a horse that was wearing a muzzle on the track system to even, I know it sounds cruel, but like we talked about, to reduce her hay intake even more.
Yeah.
And it absolutely did help her to lose weight, but also allowed her to stay on the track and be with her friends and have access to the hay that the others did. It's safe hay, it's tested, but she was just eating more than she should have every day. So it doesn't have to necessarily only be horses that are on pasture.
Yeah, it's a great point. And, you know, a lot of owners are surprised when we might recommend a muzzle when a horse has access to hay, but it's really no different than having the hay in a hay net. You know, it's just an obstacle to slow them down, whether it's a hay net or whether that, you know, quote unquote, that net is on their face in the form of a muzzle. So it's the same principle.
Right. All right. So another kind of concern or comment that I hear is that an owner's horse is only on pasture for a few hours a day or for a small amount of time. So that shouldn't be causing a problem, or it's, you know, not the reason their horse is sore. So they don't want to remove it. So is limited grass time a lower risk or automatically safer?
So I think it depends on a few things. Some horses that have been restricted, if you do let them out for just a couple hours, they can binge and they can eat a lot of their daily intake in a couple hours. The other one is what Dr. Kellen mentioned, is a time of the day. So if you are going to allow like muscle pasture access or even without, you want to make sure they're not at the times where sugars are higher on the plant. So definitely during the times where sugars are not stored in the plant. So during the day, the sun will build the sugars in the plant and they'll stay high while the sun is out. And then at night, they get used for growth. So at night when sun is not out, it is one of the best times to allow some grazing on these animals.
We should mention that the life stage of the plant too, because that's important. Once they have matured and gone to seed and dropped their seed, that's when they're the safest. They have the lowest sugar and starch at that point. So between then and when the pasture starts to go dormant and gets cold at night, that's the safest time to graze. And a lot of these grasses only have a life cycle of about 6 weeks. So if you keep an eye on the plants in your pasture and notice when they mature, when they bring the seed heads up, and when they drop them, then you'll know the safest time. And matching it, of course, the time of day as well. But that's the safest time as far as the plants go to graze the horse.
Yeah, and actually something that I don't really hear often here in the States, but what I've heard a lot in the UK is that people will, just like what you're saying, wait until that the grass has kind of matured and then they graze their horses on it, as they call it standing hay. I know that at least the times that the places that I've been in the UK, it doesn't get quite as cold there as it does where I am in Massachusetts. So I don't know how much of the risk that they have in the late fall of it dropping really cold at night and affecting the sugar levels. But I do know that they say, you know, their owners over there who will actually graze in the fall or through the fall into the winter as standing hay. So that's interesting. I just assumed that that was it, but I hadn't heard the explanation before that you were saying about the 6 week cycle and watching the maturity. So that's really cool. And I guess on the opposite side of that, so, you know, a lot of owners think that if a pasture is eaten down to basically nothing, that it's safe because they can't be getting that much. And, you know, it's so short that there's nothing there. So does short grass always mean that that's a safer alternative to, you know, a thicker pasture?
Not always. I mean, if it's really, really bad, then it's probably safer. But if it's just been overgrazed and starting to come back, then it's not safe because it'll be high sugar then. And it's high sugar from the stress of being heavily grazed. But pastures that are really severely overgrazed have exhausted their carbohydrate reserves. So they're a problem. There was one study done where I think they mowed the grass every 3 weeks or something ridiculous like that down to a really low level. And they did get it to get to the point where it was very low sugar and starch, but because they exhausted the plant's carbohydrate reserve taking away all the leaf mass. But if it's just been, you know, let's just say you had a bunch of horses out there, they went a little bit too bar, then it's not necessarily safe.
Yeah, something that I always tell my owners is, you know, how much grass would be there if you didn't put your horse out on it for a few days? And that's might be how much they're eating. because they just, you know, they assume that there's nothing out in their field, but really it's just that it's getting picked at every day. So, you know, I guess we talked about this earlier in terms of weight management for these horses, but, and I've unfortunately run into issues with working with some veterinarians about this too, when I've asked owners of a laminitic horse to get them tested for insulin resistance or PPID. And I've met some resistance with, well, the horse isn't overweight, or the horse doesn't have fat pads, or my horse is skinny, so they can't be insulin resistant, or they, you know, it's not laminitis, or it's not, you know, it's not a metabolic concern. So I know that we talked about this a little bit, but can we talk a little bit about underweight horses and their predisposition, or you know, can they be metabolic?
Yeah, absolutely. So Dr. Mesa did mention this, that, you know, not all metabolic horses are overweight and not all overweight horses are metabolic. So, you know, we think of the classic horse, or kind of the classic body type that goes alongside laminitis, as the fat, overweight, you know, pony or horse. And certainly many are, you know, many overweight horses are metabolic and have insulin dysregulation, and then they do end up with laminitis. That's a very common picture that we see. But not every horse reads that textbook. And certainly there can be horses at an ideal body weight or even underweight who still are metabolic or have insulin resistance if you test them. And those ones can be really tricky, right? Because they don't look it, but you can't be certain until you actually test them. And then I think, Dr. K, you can jump in here too, but I was going to say, I think that sort of atypical metabolic horse, that under normal weight or underweight metabolic horse, at least in my experience, many, many times those horses are concurrently Cushing's or PPID. So I think it's a little bit more common, at least in the population of horses I have experience with. It's those PPID horses that might be normal weight or underweight, but they have concurrent metabolic disease or insulin resistance, and then we might see laminitis down the road. Dr. K, what do you think?
I think the ones that only have metabolic syndrome, I think usually at least have a crest on their neck, I mean, or fat deposits above their eye. If you examine them carefully, you can see the signs, even if their general body weight is normal. Another thing that will make them thin and sometimes lose all of that is if they're chronically laminitic. The horse is in chronic pain a lot of times. Is very thin.
Yeah.
But as you said,
or at least not fat.
Yeah. But, you know, as you said, a lot of times it's the horses that have Cushing.
Yeah. And I've seen that too. Or even with some of the cases that I'm working on now, I'll start to see like a little bit of a pot belly with a ribby. You can see their ribs, or like a loss of top line. Mm-hmm. And they might be foot sore. And, the owners don't really necessarily think that there's a metabolic thing going on. They just think the horse is older and getting old and losing muscle and losing, you know, becoming a harder keeper. But a lot of times we end up getting blood work back that has that elevated ACTH, and they do so much better once on Perglide. They look so much better and healthier.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
The other thing to stress to people is there are a lot of things that can go wrong with disease besides laminitis. We get a fair number of people that come to the ECIR group convince their horse has laminitis, and it's not laminitis. I mean, yeah, navicular disease, all kinds of things that can make a horse very foot sore. So it's important to look at the breed, the animal, the details of the radiographs and the lab work before you come to any conclusion about what's wrong with it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Don't automatically blame grass or laminitis. It isn't always that.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, that kind of brings me to sort of like the roundup of the episode is, do any of you have anything that you sort of want to leave off as advice or tips or something that we might not have touched on in this episode that's important for owners to know as we're talking about this subject?
I would say for me, the big thing is that diet and management can 100% successfully manage these horses, and they can go on and live very normal, happy, healthy lives. It can take some work to get there, and it can take some stricter management. And for a lot of, you know, for a lot of owners, that can be really hard initially, but once you get the system down and you kind of get into the flow, it's doable. It's doable to manage these types of horses, and we do it all the time.
Yeah. Anything else that you kind of want to leave as like parting words?
No, I think that's it, except that now, besides fertilizer for PPID horses, we have metformin, we have flozen drugs for cases that are really bad. I mean, there are some that just don't respond to diet alone. And I don't know why that is, really. Maybe if we kept at it long enough, they would. But they're usually very laminitic also at the same time, and you really need to do something for it because they're not doing well at all. And metformin or the flozen drugs are an option if diet doesn't work.
I feel like we could have an entire podcast episode on those because I have had some owners and veterinarians that are hesitant to use them. I've seen, honestly, you know, some miracles come out of those. But, you know, obviously there's the concern with liver values and the hyperlipidemia and weight loss. I've seen, you know, some that trialed it, that just dropped so much weight so quickly. And yeah, I feel like that could be a whole discussion in itself.
Yeah, they're definitely up and coming and an important, I think I used the euphemism, tool in our toolbox already. But, you know, some of these prescription medications, working alongside your vet's really, really key when either the situation's quite dire and you need to make really, you know, need to make changes very quickly for that, the welfare of that animal. Or, you know, despite doing all the right things with diet and management, we're still really struggling. So, yeah, we have some really good drugs on the horizon, and that can be really successful for these really tough cases.
Yeah, well, I think obviously the first step is just getting the education out there about the general basics of some of these things. I think a lot of times owners are not even aware of, you know, the stuff that we talked about today, like what's a risk factor and what's not, what are symptoms and what isn't. So I really appreciate you all being so willing to chat with me on the podcast over and over again about such important topics. I always hear good feedback whenever I talk to you all. So thank you so much for being willing to join this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. Thanks for having us on.
Of course. Have a good rest of your week.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye.
I always say that I'm slightly more hoof obsessed than the average person, and chances are, if you're listening to a hoof care podcast, you are too, so we should probably be friends. Feel free to find me on Facebook or email me at thehumblehoof@gmail.com.